Hello and welcome to a new episode of When Power Podcast. I'm here today with Latanya Mapfret, former president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women, a public foundation that supports courageous activists who are fighting for justice and equality in their communities, and current and future CEO of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. We are here today to have a conversation on leadership, feminism, and her book, The Everyday Feminist. So welcome, Latanya, and thank you very much for being with us today on When Power Podcast.
Oh my God, it's such a pleasure. I just love the name of the podcast. I was all in when I saw that. So thank you for having me.
I know this is going to be a very interesting conversation. I'd like to take you straight into it with a question that I ask all my guests, and is what is that you're fighting for today?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I have to tell you, I am trying really, really hard to continue to fight for just a little bit better of a world to live in. And it's been interesting for me to think about what 2024 will hold and with all the changes that I've made. And one of those things is that we shouldn't have to fight so hard, but if we're going to fight, then God knows when I leave this world, I want it to be just a little bit better than where I found it. And so for me, it is this continuous, you know, small step-by-step perseverance that is required in order to get us to something that looks more like equity and equality and less like division and war. And even if that's just a tiny, tiny step, then that's what I'm going to fight for this year and every year that I have left on this earth.
Well, this is by hearing this, I'm already feeling empowered and so powerful that we have a woman like you fighting a fight like this. And I'm so happy to amplify your story through this podcast. And for all the people that are following us today, I would like them to know you a little bit better. What is also behind a bio that they might read online about yourself?
Yeah.
So tell me, who is Latanya and how? Where do you find the strength and the motivation to show up every day, and what inspired you to pursue a career in advocating for women's rights and gender equality?
You know, it's thank you for the question. It's I never really thought about it as more of like a motivation. It was more just like my duty. You know, it's like when you wake up in the morning and it's like you have to be thankful because you woke up this morning. You know, so in my world, it's like it's not just about working for social justice. It is just the air that I breathe. It is if I don't, who will? And if it's not a part of what I bring to the profession, you know, whether it's a lawyer, human rights advocate, you know, a feminist, then what is it worth if I can't be who I am in this work, in these movements? And so for me, growing up with the, you know, I always talk about my grandparents, you know, my grandmothers were strong forces. My sister just talked about it over the holiday break as I have both of them in me, you know, one grandparent who, you know, my Nana is very soft and, you know, humble and, you know, everybody loves her because she gives hugs and she cooks for you. She bakes for you. And then I have another grandmother who is, you know, much more of a stronger entrepreneur, has gone through a lot of things in her life, particularly racism in the U.S. And how she's had to navigate that for her and her children. So she's much more staunch. She's a businesswoman. You know, she gets up at a certain time of day. She achieves this, you know, and that success is what drove her. And my sister said, I have both of those things in me. And that combination is what makes me who I am. But I will say the inspiration for the Everyday Feminist, I had this, you know, a beautiful opportunity to work both for the United Nations and then as a foreign service officer with USAID, which allowed me then to live in, you know, to live in 15 countries, but visit many more across four continents. And it meant that I was able to meet in every single one of those countries the most amazing women fighting for gender justice. And as you know, every country has different issues that they're fighting for at different times. And so to be able to reflect on that in this book, The Everyday Feminist, what women were doing, whether it was in Iraq or Sudan or in the U.S., you know, how that affected the work that I was doing and how it actually supported an agenda that puts me where I am today, you know, whether that's at Global Fund for Women or now at Rockefeller Philanthropies. And so that inspiration, you can't pay for, right? It's just being in the company of women who want to, again, do just a little bit to make their families better, their communities better. And that inspires me because I know that. I feel that. I want that too. And so it's easy to lift up there, just like you're doing, to lift up their stories, to lift up the experiences we had in a small fight to make something just a little bit better wherever we were in the world.
I agree, and I think the more women I interview, the more I realize the inspiration and the people we are today lies in our roots, whether it's grandmothers, mothers, and it's always, you know, on the woman side of the family, there is always these strong personalities that shape us into the women that we are today. And I think it's beautiful that we live up to what they gave us, not just, you know, in terms of DNA, but also ideas and the courage to fight for something that has a meaning, you know?
That's
And
right.
and as you say, even traveling around and meeting a lot of inspiring women, as a journalist myself, I done that quite a lot. And I don't know, I'm not even able to count all the inspirational stories that I heard.
That's
And
right.
And I
That's
don't
a blessing. That's such a
exactly,
blessing.
exactly. You know, when they said that your network is your network, but in this case, it's also your inspiration and the reason why you do what you do every day, and you have the energy and the passion to get out of bed. So
And
completely.
it sounds like you, I don't know if you have kids yet, but it's like I have an 18-year-old and a 24-year-old. And right now, I mean, you know, there's years of, you know, of course, the little years, the middle years, the older years, the college. But right now, my real emphasis with them is find your passion. Find the thing that makes you get up in the morning and you don't feel like you're going to work, but that this is what you do. This is a part of what you do. And you just want to be able to do as much as you can to meet the mission of the day. So hopefully, I know I can hear it in your voice. It's certainly how I get through every day. And I just hope that more and more of us in the world are focused on that, what I call feminist spirit of just, you know, struggling for justice wherever you can find it.
Exactly, exactly. I don't have kids yet, but I consider my community as a sort of like expanded family. And if whenever I speak with a younger journalist, or even just, you know, a younger woman, what I like to say is exactly what you say, just, you know, get out of bed for something you really love. And a job is a job, but you really need to find a motivation, something much more deeper than, you know, just going and
That's right.
do a nine
That's
to
right.
five in the office and then bring home the salary. Okay, that's honorable as well, but there is much more that we can do and we can achieve.
I think sometimes when we all talk about who inspires us, what inspires us, I think sometimes we're thinking about, you know, these sort of lightning bolt charismatic leaders, right? You know, these ones who find themselves on TV and everywhere and are big influencers in our world. But I have to tell you, the stories that I write about in the book and the way that in the people that I even think about when I'm having this conversation with you, they're not that, you know, they're much more relatable. I mean, incredibly imperfect, like all of us, you know, they're human. And they're, you know, what we call ordinary women, but they have this extraordinary commitment to working towards some kind of change. And they are the ones who are showing up and like pushing forward and really getting the hard stuff done. And I feel like we need to lift that up more. I mean, you know, yes, I love Oprah. I love, you know, so many different people right now who are doing amazing things, but I think it's the women who are in these communities who are not showing up in social media feeds that sometimes I think we forget. And that's why I really appreciate what you're doing by, you know, lifting those voices up. I think our children and hopefully their children need to be able to see themselves in our influencers and not feel like they need to change themselves to be an influencer or someone that inspires others.
Yeah, I 100% agree with what you just said. And we were talking about this before, but even the people that follow Wempower, they know it's all about bringing stories of ordinary women that are changing the world. And sometimes too often they are forgotten, but they are doing amazing things and they are there on the ground fighting every day in different countries for different reason, and they deserve an opportunity to be heard. And I think sometimes we are very what we see on social media, on TV, it's really superficial. It doesn't really talk to everyone, and you don't feel like you have a connection. But the story that you wrote about in the book, which I have, by the way, I bought it and I loved it from first page to the last one, are really relatable and they're really applicable for, you know, for everyone if you just want to actively
That's
make a
right.
change and it's not, you know, something too far away from our imaginary or from our lived experience. So,
That's right.
that's what brought us here today to have this conversation, because I believe there is a very, very big alignment in terms of mission and you know, values and passion. We will talk about your book a little bit later. We can keep a bit of suspense as well for the people listening to us. So you wore different hats and you had different roles and responsibilities, and you must have also encountered some challenges across your careers. And obviously, the mission of advancing women's rights globally is not an easy one. So would you like to share maybe how you keep yourself motivated or how you face some of the challenges that you might have to face in your roles, and maybe tell us a little bit more about this?
No, I mean, I think back to when I first started, a young lawyer, human rights officer at the UN, in countries where being a woman, and especially being a young woman, and then in particular a young Black woman, was probably not like what people were expecting when I walked into many rooms. And I think, it was a little bit, it was a little bit difficult to get people to listen to me, to be able to be in the right conversations in order to make change happen. And I, you can imagine that's me working at the United Nations. Imagine these women in countries where their own leadership will not listen to them about things that's happening in their community. And I felt like these challenges were I could overcome them, but I did oftentimes need to have the comfort of the sisterhood. I think that's the thing that has made it work. And so it is always having this group of a small group of women who and intergenerationally for me, that's been how I've been inspired. So, usually it's an older woman that would advise me, and then a couple that are my age who are going through similar things, leaders in their own groups, maybe not in the same sector, but then also having some young people who were fearless and, didn't even understand what I was talking about, that has always been for me wherever I move, been extremely helpful in getting through. I think sometimes it's lonely when you start rising in some of these organizations as well. So I've had to use that same template, if that makes sense, when I move into like CEO and, executive director positions, is to make sure that I have people around me who will tell me the truth, who will advise me when I don't know what to do, who will keep me up when I'm feeling down, and who will keep me real, not tell me lies about whether I'm doing okay or showing up enough or doing things that are actually helping. And so for me, that has been the way to get through challenges, is to do it in community. And I see, how lonely it can get, not just for myself, but for other leaders, women leaders, and how they have to bat against some of the misinformation. And I think about the former president, or was she prime minister of New Zealand, Jacinta, and like how incredibly lonely that must have been for someone that was just so incredibly effective at her job, and then to step down because you really need to focus on what's really important for you. I've been there at those times when I've had to make choices for family, that I, was just kind of annoyed that my male counterparts didn't have to make those same kind of choices, right?
Yeah.
So it's been a wonderful ride, let's just say, but not without its challenges because of, my race, my sex, my age, and those are the things that I want to make better for those that are coming behind us, right? So that they don't have to make those same kind of choices and or that they can bust through those glass ceilings without feeling any problem, knowing that there's going to be sisters on both sides that are going to help them get through.
Community is a thread in this beginning of 2024. I don't know for you, it always has been, but there is a lot of talks happening on the importance of community, acknowledging, the support that we receive from our teams, even in our corporate jobs or companies. It's
Absolutely.
we couldn't make it on our own, we need the support of the network of the people around us. So really important
That's right.
to remember this.
And you know what else the network does? It reminds you, because like when we were starting this year, I mean, a lot of us are just looking at the trouble of the world, right? The things happening in Gaza and Sudan and other parts. I mean, hell, I'm in Memphis where the gun crime is like insane. Everybody has a gun. Everybody. That's kind of, we can get caught on that, or we can look, at the broader structure. One of my colleagues from Atlanta sent me an email that talked about, and you may have seen this, this little meme, but it's a what is getting better for women in the world? What is not getting worse in the world? And where there are some opportunities to change things. And so when you sit in a little bubble and you don't look broader, it may look very much like we're in a really, really bad situation. But then when you look broader, you're like, well, things are changing. There are some really good things happening around the world, things a lot to celebrate. And so for 2024, I'm really trying to lean into, that version of the story because it keeps me moving forward.
Yeah. And talking about leadership, as a leader, what do you think are the qualities that are essential for driving positive change, especially when we talk about women's right field?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I do, I'm one of those, and I'm gonna take you back a little bit because, I'm in the US and we're looking at this potential candidacy of Trump again. And remembering that he won, his presidency against a female candidate. And what was even worse was that the thing that tipped him into into a successful win was the white woman vote here in the United States. I mean, not to say, white men voted for him, but we expected him to have a large white male followership. What was unexpected, and Black folks just certainly, voted for Hillary Clinton in big ways. I think the Black woman vote was close to like 98.9% for Hillary. But that really got me, it was a white woman running, and white women didn't, fully support her. It was a large, it was just boggling, mind-boggling to me. And so when I think about how we need to really move forward, is I think there has to be some understanding of how we look at ourselves, because I don't think it's just a matter of, oh, they found the other candidate better. I think there is some, and I could be wrong, but I think there is something about what women are taught about who they are that we need to work on. And so in the power that women who actually know themselves and are fighters for social justice, I mean, you've seen it, the Me Too, I mean, we can go down the list, right? Of women who actually know themselves and have dedicated themselves to the fight for justice, how powerful they are. And that's a battle not against the world, it's a battle against ourselves. The thinking that we've been taught that we can't change the world. And so I think there's a lot of work that we have to do with ourselves and how we see ourselves fitting into a greater narrative of change, of peace, of prosperity, of abundance, as the leaders. because I do think that that is where it's going to happen. And if we ourselves continue to think and accept that we're not worthy of a presidency, or, oh, it's not, you know, you don't want a woman running the country, you know, that kind of stuff, then we're just going to waste time and set ourselves back so much. So I'm really thinking about how we as women actually battle, because you talk about what we fight for. How do we get past these narratives of us being less than something incredibly transformative, so that we can do this work, because we know we're good at it, but we just have to be able to convince ourselves that somebody that looks like us or is similar to us can also do it, because sometimes we think we can't.
So true. And I think what is important in this case is representation, which is something that it's truly missing. And it goes back as well to the stories that we mentioned before. You know, if you don't see it, you think you cannot be it. You don't have an example of what are the possibilities that are open for you out there. So I think this plays a very important role in the way as well women are perceiving themselves. What the society, the culture, stereotypes, everything, you know, tell us, like, you know, you cannot do that because you are a woman. But actually, yes, you can. But because there are examples of successful women in leadership position that we should look up for. So why not? You know, why not?
Absolutely. I love it. And I think we all have a part to play. Honestly, I think in the arts, you know, I'm just thinking, like, okay, so when Obama became the first Black president of the United States, there have been numerous movies where there was a Black president. You know, whether it's true or not, I completely agree with what you're saying. People have to see it in order to believe it, right? And I think that has a lot to do with it. It's like how we are portrayed in certain things. How we accept, you know, certain words about ourselves, all of that makes a difference in how we can lead. It is very much a big part of how people see you, and then that allows them then to trust that you will be able to lead. And so I think we have to work on a lot of that stuff internally, but also then how we accept what people call us, what they say about us, how they portray us. You know, those are things that we have to be careful of.
Exactly. And also very important not to make this an exception. You know,
right.
It happened. We had a Black president. Let's repeat that. No, it
right.
was not.
Exactly.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's
Why
amazing.
Not?
Yeah, Hollywood
That's
is
right.
keep doing it. We have
yep.
examples that it is possible. We lived it through, so
Absolutely.
why not?
Yep.
So
I totally agree.
And did you have any, I know that you said you get your inspiration from all the women you met, but did you have a mentor or someone that influenced you or help you shape your leadership style? And maybe what advice would you give to any younger woman or any younger leader that is future leader that is listening to us today and they are thinking, you know, this could be an option for them?
Well, I've had several mentors in my career, but the most recent was at Planned Parenthood, and where Cecile Richards led that organization. I always tell people, everyone knows she's a badass, and she was totally committed to disrupting the status quo. And so that was beautiful. But what was even more beautiful, and something that I tried to replicate, was that she also showed up every week. I don't care where she was in the world. I don't care what television station she had to play on. She was at staff meeting, the team meeting every week. And so that kind of commitment to not just the broader external world, but also the internal workings of an organization was something that I really admired. And I took notes on, you know, on how you do this. How do you show up, not just for the movement, I'll call it, but then how do you also show up for your family, for the people that work for you? And I think when you hold both of those things very dear, you can do it well. And so when I talk to younger people, because I don't think you can give that kind of energy to just anything, right? Mm-hmm. So again, what I was saying about my kids, it's like you have to figure out what churns your heart to do this. And if that then is a thing that you believe in and you love, It's going to be worth working for, and you'll do it well because you want to do it well. And that's the energy that changes the world that we live in. Yeah.
Again, and this is another inspiring point. I hope people that are listening to us right now, they are taking notes because we're sharing some important advice here. And you talk about this before, but I would like to bring again the focus on the communities and on building partnership as well. Again, the field of women's rights and it's not an easy one to be fighting in, and it's important to build and sustain partnership even with other organizations, governments, and stakeholders. So how do you make sure you can maximize the impact that you want to make through this partnership, and how do you actually, build this partnership, which are fundamental for your work?
I am about to go on in my first 90 days with with Rockefeller, 90 days of what I think I'm calling radical listening. We did a year of learning at Global Fund for Women, and to me, they're the same thing. I don't think you can really know what to do if you're not listening to what people are trying to deal with. A lot of times we think we know what the issues are, and I think you have to take some time to really listen. The one thing I've learned by living all over the world is that the issues are not the same. They're not articulated the same. We may boil them down to like it's a climate issue, you know, but I've now been to working with movements in the Pacific. Working with movements in the Caribbean, working with movements in Sub-Saharan Africa, and of course in the communities of the US. It's a very different thing what they're all working for. And unless you literally sit down and listen to what their issues are, because they may not all call it the same thing. And in fact, I think many of them for years have been calling it very different things. It's not like they just came into the climate movement. Most of these groups have been doing this work for decades. Decades, because this has been happening for decades. This environmental degradation that, you know, people saw, and particularly because it affected poor communities far before it affected others. And so from my perspective, taking the time to listen before you jump has been really, really important. And then distinguishing you know, what that work looks like for different communities is so very important. And those two things for me has I feel like have helped me be able to chart a course that has profound impact. I think people look at my time at Global Fund for Women and they're like, you've done so much there. And I think the only reason I was able to do that is because not only was I prepared to listen in a radical way, but people were gracious enough to tell me what I needed to learn. And so I think with those two things, impact is guaranteed because you know now what people need, and then you come with hopefully some choices that they can pick up as support for them. We have what we call at Global Fund for Women, a concept of movement-led work, which is a concept of trying to understand what people need when they need it so that we can get them the resources that they need and how they need it, right? So it's simple, it's very simple, but it is what impact boils down to. It's if you think you're going to create something for other people and that they're going to take that up and run with it, then I think impact looks very, very difficult. But impact is the partnership. So what you're talking about is how do you make impact in a partnership? It is to partner. It is to listen. It is to learn, and it is to act together in partnership.
Just a question coming from this, because in when it comes to NGOs, charities, human rights fights and activism, there are so many association, organization, community, and it's important that each one of them is dedicated to their fight. Perhaps sometimes it's the same fight in different countries or in this in different area, but do you believe that the impact would be much stronger if sometimes we don't divide the attention on many different entities and we group some under the same umbrella?
I do think, but it's that's a little bit different. Impact in the community to me is the success that we're looking for. So it's very difficult to show impact at a global scale. I know sometimes we'd like to believe it and we cobble numbers together, but if the people can't feel the impact, then there is no impact. I don't care how you statistically show your numbers. One of the things that that I created with Global Fund for Women is an accountability program with UN Women and the Generation Equality Forums that happened in 2021, I believe. And part of that was to say, you can't have governments or corporations, multinational corporations, say and commit to something. And then when you ask them if, a year later, if they've actually done that, did they have impact? They're like, yes, we had impact. A lot of them will just say stuff like, oh, we committed $1 billion and we spent $1 billion. And you're like, but is that impact? And so what we asked is, and what we've gotten support from other donors to do, to partner with us on, is actually ask the people who are impacted by the challenges of the day. So if we're talking gender justice, let's just say climate justice, violence against women, who should we be asking if that impact is happening? Has there been impact? Have you felt any change? We should be asking the people in the communities, the people that are actually the recipients of those challenges and trying to deal with them. And so we actually started a program where we now have built some capacity among organizations, research, and otherwise around the world to actually answer the question. So I don't know, let's just use an example. Government of Sudan said that they're committing $10 million to violence against women. Then the question is not to the Sudanese government, did you spend that money, which is impact, but it's to the women. Did you feel any change because of the money that was spent? And so I think if we start thinking about it that way, I think impact will start to have a new meaning. In the women's funding world, we get tired of the word impact because the way that people are using it is actually has nothing to do with the communities. It has everything to do with numbers and dollars and cents. And what we're trying to overemphasize is the impact it has on the people who are experiencing the challenge. And so I think we have to just be laser focused on what impact means and ask the right people whether impact has happened.
Thank you. This was not a planned question, but I had curiosity because I've been speaking with many activists as well and organization here in the UK, and sometimes maybe they're obviously they're on a smaller scale, but the sensation that they have is sometimes there are too many entities focusing on the same issue, and maybe gathering them together to make them stronger to have a bigger and more important impact rather than just, I don't know, ticking the box of yes, we did this, we used this money, we implemented this, but actually then people on the ground they're still not seeing any results. So it's a bit depending obviously on the field where you are, but getting together, like we said before, you know, having the support of your community obviously will make the effort bigger and you know the changes will be more efficient as well, I think.
I guess, and I agree. And I know there are, like, when I was with Planned Parenthood at PPFA, I think when we went in, there were like 200 and something affiliates in the US. And then I ran the global side, so, the international side. But on the domestic side, that went down to something like 60, over a period of like 10 years. And certainly there was some strength in that, sort of, collaborating and partner on the back end while still being a local partner to their communities. And I think that was brilliant. It went off. And it probably would, for folks that are saying this, it would probably be an example of how that can, could be a model for how we work with NGOs so that they can come together. But the reason I talked about impact to the community and how we hold ourselves accountable to the community is because the question is not how many organizations are doing the same things with the same communities, but what is the impact they're having on the community? And so this is a question I'm saying we have to ask to the community. It's not just a numbers game. It's not just a efficiency game. It's about, are we actually addressing what the needs of that community are? So if we talk about survivors of sexual abuse, it is not a think tank, Bridgebanner, or you know, McKinsey or something that needs to decide, oh, if all of these 20 organizations came together, put all their money together, then they'd have a bigger impact. No, the question is to the community of survivors is, are these organizations in their current format actually, you know, helping with the resources that you need as survivors, or would you think some other kind of format? And I know that for years, and hopefully that's changing, asking those questions, you know, would be termed as, well, they don't know, you know, we're the experts. And I push back on that, because I absolutely, you know, my mother was a, and I think if you read the book, you saw, you know, actually experience violence and, you know, domestic violence. And I look at how she's turned herself around, and there are millions of her who can right now tell you, you know, how that happened, what was useful for them, how that looked, what didn't work for them. Mm-hmm. And I think if we just try to lean into that more and stop considering ourselves experts, and think of ourselves more as facilitators, think of ourselves more as conduits, amplifiers, and even to me, leaders, right? You know, because that's to me what a leader does. And ask those questions and listen to the answers and move based on what we've learned, I think we'd have more accountability. And it actually makes those kind of decisions of what I just said around Planned Parenthood happen, because your drive is not some artificial definition of impact, but your drive is how accountable you are to the communities you work for.
A chapter is about to close for you, which is you said at the beginning, but we mentioned it throughout the interview, and is that it's closing the chapter of the Global Fund for Women for you, and you're starting a new one with the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. And my question is, what do you think was the most significant achievement that you had with your leadership with the Global Fund for Women?
That's a great question. I've been, of course, talking about this a lot as I'm moving forward. And I did talk a little bit about the movement-led approach, because, you know, understanding the role of philanthropy as following social justice impact is a phenomenal way of thinking about things. Most of my career, whether it was at the UN, USAID, or with foundations, has been, we'll come up with a plan to make you people do better. And I'm almost 30 years in this work now. And what I've seen is the opposite. It's like they need to tell us what they need in order to move forward. And my predecessor is going to talk, my successor will talk more about this in her tenure. But what we started was an opportunity to actually look for movements when they needed us most. What we knew for sure was that when movements are emerging, when things, because usually it's a spark, right? Something has happened, something tragic has happened, and it makes people come together. And they take to the streets, they take, you know, they take to their leaderships, their parliaments, their governments, to try to change something that has happened. When those things are happening, usually the organization hasn't been formed yet, right? It's a issue that happening around. I mean, it happens everywhere all the time, to be honest. But when it's happening, that's when the input of resources is the most useful, to try to get them from emerging mass kind of work that's happening and organizing to something that then can be sustainable and continue that work and adds for a particular outcome. And in order to do that, you do need resources. But it's also at the same time that none of those people are actually sitting down, going online, saying, well, who's funding this kind of stuff, right? You know, it's the opposite. We should be looking for them. And I'm glad at Global Fund for Women, and one of the just many, because we don't have time. I'm so proud of so much at Global Fund for Women. But one of the many things is that we've started the Gender Justice Data Hub that does this exact thing. We're actually tracking when movements are emerging. We're actually contacting them through advisors that we've been working with, who are mostly, you know, graduated grantee partners. And we're working with them saying, okay, we look through all the public information using AI and all that's available to us, social media, and we see that something is about to happen in this place, this region, this country, this community. Are there organizations that are working on this that we can connect with the movement the organizers of these movements so that they can get resources, if we can give resources or if other donors can give resources to bring that in at a time when they actually most need it, I think would be it's just going to be groundbreaking, and I can't wait to see how that continues at Global Fund for Women, because I know that there are a number of us that, including donors to Global Fund for Women, we're a public foundation, who, continue to support and stand by organizations, but we also now need to be ready to ante up when something new is coming, and to make sure that this new breed of organizing, of social justice, gets the support they need to continue to do that work, and to hopefully lead us to successes even faster in the work that we're doing.
And we're looking forward to see what the
Yes.
future holds for the
Yes.
Global Fund for Women. Talking about your book, you said what inspired you to write it briefly. If you want, you can tell us a little bit more. But I would like to know, when you were writing this book, what you wanted the readers to take away while reading
Yeah.
it.
And the
What
interesting thing
message?
is the title that we came up with, because it's, and it's in the business section of the bookstore, so it almost looks like it's a, it's a conversation on how to be a good feminist, right? It actually is nothing like that. And probably I would say out of the 8 or 9 spotlighted women that I put in the book, not even half of them would call themselves feminist. I mean, they might consider it, but they probably don't, in whatever region or country they live in. And the thing is that what I was trying to do was to talk to supporters of this kind of work, and I use the everyday feminist as a way to get some attention to the women who are doing this work, who don't do it for the glory, who don't have their stories told very often. I mean, I do have Tarana in there. I have Loretta Ross in there. Tarana from Me Too, Loretta Ross from the reproductive justice movement. But in general, the women in the book are not, and certainly the two of them before they became, famous. It's not about their how they show up as individuals, but it's about how they had to shape something to bring attention to it and then to keep it moving. Any one of these ladies in this book, including the young women that I spotlight, could be presidents of a country just because of the way that they've had to engage around an issue and just completely change the way people think about it. And that is the story, right? It's not, I don't care if they ever became popular or famous, but it is, how do we continue to tell this story, which is repeated? I mean, these people don't know each other. These are women from different parts of the world. At the beginning of the book, I talk about Innocent, who's a hairdresser in Kenya. Again, could be the president of Rwanda easily. I mean, it is this thing that they do and that they have that we need to look at not just as a fluke, because it's happening too much around the world, but as an actual resource to make change happen. And I call it transformative change. And so we actually need to be on the lookout for these type of people and communities who are doing this work. And then we need to support them. So that's the whole theory behind the book, is like, what is that change that we're looking for? Who is making that change happen? How do we find them? And then how do we continue to support them? Not at so minimal level. And I talk about things that stop us from doing this too, right? It's like this whole concept around only funding people you know or that look like you, or thinking people in the global South are not as educated, or all of these kind of ridiculous things that we've had to overcome. But really trying to truthfully partner with communities and the leaders, and particularly women leaders in those countries, to make sure that we're I'll even use, making a impact that is sustainable. I'll use those words.
I think it's a really beautiful book, and it's also a very interesting perspective on feminism to try
Yes.
to reframe it a bit, as it I believe in the past years has either been stereotyped as a, feminists are just ugly women that, they are arguing with everyone. Or,
Yes.
and it's just to make it look, as you say, not everyday feminist, like everyone can be. And you are not just, we are not feminists because we hate men or we hate
Right.
We are
has
feminists
nothing to do with
because we have
that.
a cause that we want to fight for, and it's beautiful for that. It's just a different narrative,
Thank
a different
you.
perspective. I
Thank
truly
you.
enjoy it, and if none of the people that is listening to us today, if you haven't read it yet, please give it a
Thank
try.
you.
And it's a beautiful book. So thank you
Thank
for,
you.
sharing your network and the women you met with us and their incredible stories. I think it's quite inspirational.
Thank you.
Writing a book is not an easy thing, I guess.
No, and not while you have a day job like the Global Fund for Women, right?
Exactly. So what's your secret? And no, maybe not the secret, but also what advice would you give if someone that is listening to us today decided, I would like to write a book, and with a full-time job so important like the one you had, share something for us.
Well, if I had to do it over again, I would probably do it differently. I was probably way too, I call it my sort of COVID brain fog, So things like went crazy. I've had a career where I've had the pleasure of being able to travel all the time. And it just suddenly stopped, right? And so then, I've spoken to some of my colleagues at other organizations who felt like a book was a really good way of highlighting the work of an organization. And that's how it kind of got started, that little seed in my head. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm gonna write a book. I've never written a book. I just kind of jumped in without thinking, went out, got a publisher who gave me like maybe a 11-month deadline to get the book in after we kind of discussed everything. And then I said, well, I'll take weekends and I'll do it. And the closer I got to the deadline, I was like nowhere near finished. And I will say the thing that maybe put me over the hump was a couple of things, having the support of the board of the Global Fund for Women, and particularly the chair, who offered up a sabbatical, a 3-month sabbatical, a month of which was at the Rockefeller Foundation Bellagio Center in Italy, of which the residence program there for artists, which include authors, was an opportunity to get support from a small group of people. I think we were 12, no, maybe 20, who offer you advice. Some of them had written like 20 books, right? So they knew the process. And so it really was trying to, meet a deadline. I don't recommend doing it that way. It was very difficult, but I do recommend finding artist residencies like the Rockefeller Foundation. It was just such an incredible experience to have the gathering of expertise that I had that I was able to enjoy, and just some time off to do it. You do need that. It's impossible to do while you have a day job. But the other thing I would say is I think a lot of people do it the way of actually writing and giving yourself the time and space to write, and then go look for a publisher, and then you can clean it up and stuff, but you've put, your sort of all your love and energy into something over a number of years. And then you found the publisher and then you started to move it into the world. That's probably a much easier pace, but I'm an everyday feminist. I was
We
like, I
do
can
things
do
our
this.
way.
Hard way is the better way, and I jump right in, and I don't regret it. And sometimes I even pick up parts of the book and wonder, how I did it in the space of time and with the things that were on my plate. But I have to, and I am a spiritual person, so I have to think it was just a God's way of putting something down that was important, not just for me, but I think for my organization and for the world.
And are there any future projects or initiatives that are related to the book that you maybe would like to share or explore with us today? Is there going to be maybe another book, a second
Well,
volume
here's the
with
funny
more
part.
stories?
I said, so now I'm almost a year into the release date. So March 8th, and we're going to have a big celebration over at the City University of New York. It actually launched over at Columbia University where I teach. But now we're going to have the sort of 1 year anniversary as a much larger event over at the City University of New York. And I was thinking the thing I would say at that event was that I'm never going to write a book again. But the closer I get to the event, the more I'm like sort of taking that out of my lexicon and changing, my theory. So maybe there's something else in me. It would certainly be after I retire. But I do value what it has done, the conversations it started, the opportunity to meet so many amazing people around the world to have a discussion around what everyone knows. Once people understand what it means, everyone re relates to it because they know it's true. I don't care if it's just the PTA, you know, what we call the Parent Teacher Association, that's led by this amazing, maybe even sometimes obnoxious woman, right? But that's getting this amazing stuff done, you know, every year, delivering. That everyone understands it. And I think there's a relatable way of talking about it so it doesn't sound so distant, and that feminism doesn't sound like it's a sect of people that's out there, like you said, you know, hating men and arguing points around gender, you know, and focusing on things that maybe are not so like pronouns and stuff, but rather everyday things that people are dealing with around the world. So
Well,
maybe
let's see. Maybe in, I
let's
don't know,
see.
in 5 years' time, we're gonna have another
Yeah,
conversation on your
that's
next
right. Yes,
book
we'll be
or,
talking about your book though,
oh,
5 years.
maybe. Let's see. Let's see. You know, I always had an idea of that I wanted to write a book. And actually, my dad keeps telling me, he wrote a book himself. He keeps telling me, when are you gonna write yours? And I said, it's not time
Yes.
yet. So let's see. Let's see. Let's
Let's see
wait
what
for
5 years brings.
that.
Yes. And
Let's
all the
see.
stories from your podcast might make a book, right?
Why not? Why not?
Yes.
What are you most up for the future of feminism and the feminist movements in general? We are going towards the end of this conversation. I want to finish on a more, even more positive and inspirational way.
No, I mean, I'm excited. I am, you know, at this point, thinking a lot about what leadership looks like in the world. There was a story on, I believe it was CNN, of a town, I think it's in Missouri or something, where their entire city council and their mayor, so this is local politics, right? Were just voted in November, so they started in January 1st, and they're all women. And so I'm like, you know, this is going to be exciting. You know, no, you know, like in many countries, they have like these quotas and stuff like this. None of that. You know, they just were voted in, you know, they won. They weren't like sort of nominated by someone because they had to nominate them. So I am just very interested in what's going to happen with this all sort of female council with the female mayor, and what differences you can draw from that. So from my perspective, this it also, you probably know this though, this year is the first year in history with the most elections, national elections happening, right? So I think it's like 64 or 65 of them. And so I'm really interested in political leadership this year. I'm really interested to see what feminist leadership looks like, how we do at the ballot as a group. Like now I'm bringing you back to sort of the much more global piece, of course, because you might end up with, you know, two, three of these, you know, women winning, and they're not that great. You know, I want to be real. I mean, you know, just because it's a woman winning doesn't mean that it's great
Look
for
at the
their
Italian
communities, for their
president.
nation. Exactly.
I didn't want to say,
You said
sorry.
it, I didn't, right? You
And it's
know,
my own country. I
that's
as
right.
much as I'm
Well, that's
proud
why
of
you
having
can
a
say it.
woman, it's not her that we want. But yeah, I do know what you mean.
Yeah, so but I'm thinking more of sort of this year has this opportunity to see, and I'm a believer, I'm an optimist, many more women winning around the world. And then what does that look like for our movement around social issues? We already see some of it, right? We saw the best countries did the countries that did the best during COVID were countries led by women. I mean, you know, hands down. But now, what does that look like when you have a much greater percentage of women running countries on, you know, whether it's public health issues, social justice issues, or other things? And what does that look like? So, if I sound excited about what's about to happen, I am. I also am not naive, and I understand the potentials of the, you know, the sort of fundamental, you know, ist, should I call them, you know, those on the far right, and things that they also have the potential to do. But what I am going to believe in and look forward to this year is how I can support feminist leadership, political campaigns that are being sought by women in parts of the world where I maybe can have some opportunity for my seat at Rockefeller to be able to support that.
I'm looking forward to see how, and to read more about this as well. And
Yes.
Given your leadership role and obviously being involved in advocacy work and activism is can be quite challenging to balance self-care and to prioritize self-care. So, what do you do personally to for your well-being, and what advice would you give to for all the women that are listening to us and maybe they have a similar role or something? How can you keep yourself well and in such a challenging position?
It's been it's actually, I think this balance with family and work and your position in life, because that changes too, as you know. It's like not just your career, but sort of, whether you're married or not, whether you have kids or not, and what's happening with your elder parents and things like that. I think, as folks who work hard also have to play hard, and so I think you have to, my husband says that it's the feminine spirit, the masculine spirit, and then it's the child spirit, and I really like that, because this, I think we forget sometimes this child piece, this piece of just letting go, dreaming, playing just for no reason, hugging, doing things that, you might have never done before, and relishing in looking forward to things that you've never done before. So all of those things, I think, are going to be incredibly important to balance. And to be honest with you, when it's not balanced, you see it. So leaders, I mean, you don't think that if you don't take care of yourself, that it won't get noticed. It gets noticed. It makes it difficult, not just for you, but for everyone around you. And so my advice is to really play hard, get out when you put the work down, when you need to, and run into a, hell, a field of cotton candy or whatever. But yeah, get out and play hard so that when you show back up for these fights, that you are ready and you are inspired. So whatever it takes to do that, I think is important. And I don't think there's a prescription to that. I see, this is like, oh, do more yoga, do more exercise, do more this or that. I think it just depends on the person and what makes you feel like you can get away and what makes your child spirit comes out.
I love this. Oh, and do you have an award for your 2024?
A word?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. I guess I'm gonna have to use this word though, because it's a transforming. So, so much has happened, right? So I'm changing jobs. I have a, my new husband. I'm an empty nester, which, for those folks that don't know that term, is that I no longer have the primary role of mother for anyone right now. They're all gone, from the home and doing their amazing things. So those are like, for me, the new things. So transformation is what I'll have to use for 2024. Who am I without all those things, with these
Well,
new things, the new job, the new husband? I'm transforming into something that I don't know what it is yet, but I can't wait to find out.
a new you. That's
That's
beautiful.
right.
That's
Yes.
beautiful. And to conclude this beautiful interview, remember at the beginning I asked you a question, and the one to wrap up everything is, what is that you wish to stop fighting for?
That's a good one. I wish to stop fighting for identity and, issues. So I know that sounds kind of weird, but the beauty of intersectionality, we talk about it a lot, right? Sort of these things that make people human, really. And we talk about it in the feminist movement enough. So you have like these, counterbalancing identities, and those intersections then are often seen as challenges. I would love to stop fighting against that and actually lean into it. I think having, like an incredible array of both identities and intersections of those identities is what makes us such rich communities. It's what makes us incredible people to talk to. It's what makes us like better than a social media account. You know, those are the things that I want to stop fighting against. I have these multiple intersections, and I think the intersection of them is what makes me beautiful. And so I wish we would stop talking about it like it's a problem, you know, and start leaning into it as more of a desirable condition.
I love it. I love it. Well, what a beautiful way to end this conversation. It's not end. I think it's a to be continued. Let's see
Yes,
in 5 years' time, find us
you'll have to bring
here.
us all together as a group, and we
Why not?
get to
Why
hang out with
not?
each other. That's right.
Well, it was truly a pleasure to have you here on WEMPOWER Podcast, Latanya, today. I truly enjoyed this conversation. I hope everyone that
Likewise.
listened today and tune in, you had fun with us. You discovered something new
Yes.
and you feel inspired as I am. So thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you to Wind Power. Thank you for doing this. I think it's so important.